In 1919, he hit 29 home runs and was sold to the New York Yankees.
A three-run home run for Buffington. The Yankees now lead it by a score of 3-2.
Bill Lee is now going over to a couple of the Yankees, and there they go again.
Swung, hits it to deep left. That might send the Yankees to the World Series.
Varitek and A-Rod going at it. Roberts is going. Posada's throw. Roberts, safe.
And what can I say? Just dip my heart and call the Yankees my daddies.
Welcome to Fanbase, a deep dive into the greatest rivalry in sports. Brian Shackman here, John Senecal, as always, episode 139 with Ray Fagnant. This to me is sort of like the Willie Yan, Bobby Dickerson, Rico Bronya, like to be involved with people who are so either experienced at the game or have been around it for so long. He's currently the Northeast Regional Scout for the Boston Red Sox. Ray, it's great to have you on the program. Happy New Year.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So, scouting still exists, just so you know. I mean, I think people read or watch Moneyball and they're like, well, what do they have to do? They're in there looking for Fabio and it's all the numbers. And so I think it'd be really interesting to start. Just tell us a little bit about your backstory as a player, and then how you became a scout, and then what you do today. And of course, John, you interject with any follow-ups as you go.
Well, long story short, which I can rarely do, I grew up in Western Mass, passionate about baseball. You know, it was my father's passion that he, you know, spread on to me. He was always the ideal little league dad, if you will, was always very supportive. Never, ever had a negative word. He'd be there to throw BP to me, but just really fostered my love for baseball.
What did he do for work that allowed him to do that?
He worked 60 hours a week at his own business.
He wasn't a professional.
He
former
was not,
player.
No, he ran a TV repair shop that, you know, was in the family for 50, 60 years, but he found the time. He found the time to see my games and be around. And so I played at Holyoke Catholic High School, but I knew I always wanted to play professionally. You know, it's a dream, but that's what it was for me. But I was convicted and was not highly recruited out of high school as a 140-pound catcher.
Wait, you were convicted?
No,
conviction. Like
I was convicted.
Okay, is this a part of the backstory I didn't read about? Okay,
no,
you knew what you wanted to do.
Yep. So,
didn't go D1. You didn't.
I didn't. I reached out to some schools. Yeah, I did pretty well in high school, but I reached out to some schools, and you know, Assumption College. Just I approached them, but it just seemed like a good fit. You know, my Legion coach was a real mentor to me in Chicopee, and I went and visited Assumption, and we literally set foot on campus. I told my dad, I said, this is it. And I went there, and the irony, you know, what year are we talking about? I graduated high school in 82. So I went to Assumption and loved the school, loved the coach, worked out well, and I just lifted a lot of weights, drank a lot of milk, and turned out to had a pretty good career. And, you know, the draft was, you know, it's 20 rounds now, but it was really short back then. But I did not get drafted, but I knew I wanted to play. So I just kept going to trial camps, calling scouts. And then I was playing in the Springfield Tri-County League and the Hartford Twilight League, just play as much as I could. And I ended up, you know, scout from the Pirates, who had seen me a lot in college, but came to a game one day and, you know, I had a good game. And he said, hey, you know, we want to sign you. So it's ironic, you know, you play so much baseball. This scout had seen me, and it's almost as though my career literally came down to one at-bat. And that one at-bat was against a pitcher I played against in Little League, in high school, in college.
You knew him.
I knew him. Didn't have a whole lot of success about him, against him, but did hit a ball that I don't know, went 447 feet. That I do remember, but hit a home run.
You don't forget those.
Did not. And every time we drive through East Long Meadow, I'm sure to go.
No, you weren't a home run hitter. You're not a power hitter, though, are you?
I hit 30 in college.
You hit 30.
So I'd say I was not a home run hitter other than I hit a lot of home runs college.
You know, so you had to recruit yourself to a D3 school.
D2.
Sorry, it doesn't really exist anymore, though. Right. I mean, it's just, I think a D1 and D3, but D2. And then you have a really good career there, and you have to recruit yourself to pro ball.
Absolutely.
You just wanted it that bad. But that's so different than, like, today. Like, you literally were, like, barnstorming. You were just playing wherever you'd get a chance to go in the lineup, and then one day, luckily, somebody saw you. I feel like the lesson is, I try to tell my kids, especially athletes, little things matter. It's how you back check. What do you do when you don't have the ball? Like, you had to be on all the time for that one random moment that mattered.
Huge. And it's like I say, it was my passion, is what I really want to do. So I was lucky, signed with the Pirates.
How much?
Contract. I was a non-drafted free agent, so I signed for a contract. And he gave me a hat. Bob Whalen, God rest his soul, he signed me. And
here's a hat, kid.
Yep.
Here's your signing bonus.
And signed the contract at Roy Rogers off of the Mass Pike near Worcester. You've been by there a million times, I'm sure. But went out, was with the Pirates, had a decent spring training. You know, it was an extended spring, was in the Gulf Coast League, but there were just so many players.
How many catchers were above you?
Oh, in the organization or the team? Yeah. You know,
15?
I mean, that's throughout the organization, yeah.
Probably.
But, you know, and again, even though there's 15 catchers, you know, two are prospects. The other 13 are there to, you know, kind of play catch with the other prospects. But I got let go by the Pirates. Came back, went right back to work in the Twilight in the Tri-County League, and because I still wanted to play. But
what year is this?
This was in 88. But you
what made you think you could still do it? Like, what made you hang on to it?
When I was the Pirates, I could see some of the stuff that I could do physically. Like, I had some ability. Just didn't get a whole lot of at bats, but I knew I could catch and throw. Like I said, a pretty good power. You know, I hit the ball as far as anybody. You know, I remember it was a major league game. You go and take BP and just, you know, hitting the ball out. That I could do. At, you know, like they say, at 5 o'clock, I could hit the ball as far as anybody. You know, the lights came on, not so much. But so, you know, reality kicks in, though. And like I said, my parents were so supportive. So at that point, I made the big move from, you know, my bedroom to my parents' basement. You know, but they supported me, and I got a real job, if you will, at Cigna in Hartford. I was an actuary, and because I did do very well in school. That's something that my parents preached, and you know, my boys do very well. But that, you know, the school part kind of came easy, and I got a master's at Assumption. I took an extra year that worked out well. So I was an actuary at Cigna, which was a pretty cool job. But I knew I still wanted to play. So on June 20th of 89, I'm sitting at my desk about 12 noon, and I get a call from Ed Kenny, the Red Sox farm director. I said, "Ray, we need a catcher. You still want to play?" I said, "Absolutely." He says, "Are you ready to play?" I said, "I played last night, you know, in a local league. I'm good to go." He said, "Good, because, when can he?" I figured it'd be, you know, New York Penn League or Gulf Coast League or something. He said, "We need you in New Britain." Because when can he be there?
That's double A.
Double A. And I said, "Oh, about 20 minutes." He's blown. He goes, "Well, what about your job?" I said, "Like, I don't care. I'm going." So I went into my boss's office and explained to him. He goes, "That's really cool." And, you know, he was such a nice man. He started going through the HR manual and said, "Hey, we can give you a leave of absence. We want you to do this. Go play. Just whatever the time's right, you know, come back or what have you." So I went and I got in a double. I played that night. There's a doubleheader. And, you know, that Friday we're playing Harrisburg Senators, which was ironic because that was the Pirates affiliate. And so many of those guys, I looked across the field like I knew them from the Pirates. And they kind of looked at me and, you know, like, kind of, what are you doing here? And it was neat because about 150 people from Cigna went to the game.
Oh, that's fun.
And so, you know, I was in double A for a couple weeks.
Did you find out why? Why they needed you? Like, what happened?
Yes. Specifically, Eric Wedge was a fourth-round pick out of Wichita State.
Yeah, I remember him.
He didn't sign right away. He was holding out. And Todd Pratt, who played sneaky maybe 10, 12 years in the big leagues, had the walk-off home run in the ALCS one year. He broke his hand. And so, you know, there I am. And it was pretty cool. So I was there for about 2 weeks, and Pratt came back. And I got sent, you know, they want to keep me in the organization, so I got sent down to Winter Haven. And this kind of cool story I'll say as quickly as I can, which I still struggle doing, but
no problem.
We played a game in New Britain, and the manager, it was Butch Hobson, said, you know, we're sending
Mr. Chips?
Down. That's it. It was Butch. He said, we're sending you down to Winter Haven, the Gulf Coast League. And at that time, we had the Gulf Coast League and the Florida State League were in the same place. So I go down to Winter Haven. And that morning, I'm playing a Gulf Coast League game on the AAA field. And see the man, Dave Holt, the manager of the Florida State League team, see him come down the hill from the big stadium in the golf cart. And I get called off the field. I'm catching. I get called off the field. And the manager says, "Hey, Ray, you're going up." So I got called up to high A, which was, you know, metaphorically big, but literally a 150-yard move, but I played that night because John Flaherty, who played a long time, he broke his hand the night before. So I was in a lineup that night.
So you're in a spring training major league lineup game? Or is that just in like a...
No.
He was in high A.
Oh, so you're playing in the Florida State League.
Yeah, in the Florida State League. Okay. So it turns out where in the span of a little over 24 hours, I played in games of three levels, which was kind of neat.
Double A, low A, high A.
Yep. And that night, I remember facing, of all people, Jack Morris pitched.
Jack Morris?
Jack Morris, he was rehabbing from surgery. So he pitched in Lakeland.
Mustache and all.
Hall of Famer.
I was 2-for-3 that night. I ended up hitting a home run.
Off of Jack Morris?
Yeah. And
holy crap.
Jack Morris did not care.
Right, because he was just
it's his 40 throws. I kind of kid, like, he wasn't throwing that hard that night because he didn't want the sutures to come out. But, you know, he got his throwing in and left. But it was, you know, it was two for three. The home, and probably should have quit the game because that was my career highlight there that night, probably.
It's incredible. Did he ever get in, by the way? Did Morris get in the Hall of Fame?
Yes, he's a Hall of Famer. I think 2018, I think he went in. But, the interesting part about that, and you're being very modest, though. I mean, that home run was your only professional home run?
That with the Reds, yeah.
With the Red Sox.
Yeah.
So, by the way, we're talking with Ray Fagnan, who's the Red Sox Northeast Regional Scout here on Fan Base, a deep dive into the greatest rivalry in sports. If I could go back to one thing you said you could hit the ball far, and then 5 o'clock hit, the lights came on. And what's the difference? You know, like, is it pressure? Is it, what is it?
100% mental. I remember playing a big game at Assumption. And granted, it's college baseball, but it was a big game. And one of the players on the team, I said, what's the matter? He goes, I'm just so nervous. And that was a concept I could not comprehend, being nervous in a game. Like, that was fun. Like, there was no situation in my career at any point in a college game, a summer college league game, where I was ever nervous. And so I remember getting a pro ball and not being I wasn't nervous, but I was not confident. Yeah, you know, I didn't have that confidence. I can remember, for instance, that night, you know, 2-for-3, my first game with the Red Sox, I'm thinking, oh man, I can't, you know, I don't think I can do this tomorrow. You know, so much of it is mental. And then, you know, if you were to go to spring training, I'm sure you guys have been there, you see all the players in the field. They've all got ability. Everybody's got major league tools. Mm. Now, obviously, there's some, you know, the tools that are elite are, you know, the hitting. And when I mean hitting, I mean the ability to go up to the plate and get hits. That and guys that can pitch or command and control. But the physical tools, you know, everybody has them. Mm. You know, if you were to see an infield practice or BP, you know, pick a couple of kids from low A, a couple of kids from rookie, some from double A, some triple A, some from the big leagues. You throw them out in BP or infield practice, you probably couldn't tell the difference because they all have those physical tools. But it's those that are, you know, and some are just born with the ability to hit that, you know, that you have. And some are just so confident. They know, you know, they can throw up a 1-for-27 slump and they don't care. They know they're going to succeed.
I remember talking to Rico Bronya about this, and he said to the effect that people are like, oh, you're 500 at-bats a year. Like, what's an 0-for-4? He said, well, you go 0-for-4, and then you go 0-for-4 again. All of a sudden, you feel like you'll never get a hit.
You start telling yourself you can't hit.
Ever again. And the pressure mounts. So the fact that you have multiple at-bats doesn't change the fact that you still haven't gotten a hit, and you're going up there thinking, I don't know if I can ever get a hit again. You know, like when you put it in that framework, it can be positively frightening.
Yeah, and I remember not playing every day. You know, you get a bat here, a bat there. I come in on defense, get up. Hit a ball hard to center field for, you know, an L8. And you don't play every day. You look up, man, I'm 1-for-22. You know, that's when it – and I don't get a whole lot of a bat. So that's when the stats can really be skewed. But it's and you think about something you've done your entire life, and it gets really hard all of a sudden if you let it. But that was the biggest thing to answer your question, why in pro ball it was just completely, completely mental.
Huh. But it's also, I mean, you if you're not getting the reps, I mean, you can take all the batting practice you want, but if you're not playing in games and seeing all that stuff, I mean, Bobby Dickerson is a perfect example. He's a friend of mine. He's a major league coach now, and he was kind of in the same situation. He would be the back end of a doubleheader guy. He'd come in, he'd play utility infielder, wasn't playing all the time. Someone would get hurt. He'd get a string read play for 2 weeks. And you had to make the best of it, and you'd always look up on the Jumbotron, and his average was nowhere near where it probably should have been, but he was that standout in college. He was a really great player, but like you said, you get there and everybody's a stud around you.
Bobby, so it's hard. You just dropped a Bobby Dickerson on me.
Yeah.
Of course, I have a story with him.
Good. I'd love to hear this.
We're playing AA. We're playing Hagerstown. And I remember Al Sanders is pitching. He got to AAA, good pitcher, but he gives up a hit, and he gives up a home run, and the hitter really pimped it. Eric Wedge was on the team. This is the second game of doubleheader. He caught the first game. And so, I can say it now at this point.
Yeah.
Eric said, you got to drill somebody. You got to drill somebody. So Bobby Dickerson's batting, and we hit him. He's a good dude. Kind of didn't know what to do.
He can get mad.
But I get up right away, because catcher's job, you get up, you get in front of him. Yeah. And so it was kind of like, all right, Eric, what do we do here? And so he starts getting a little aggressive. So I just remember I could hear it. It's coming. The bench is empty. Because every team's got one or two guys that are looking for that. And the bench is empty. Next thing you know, I am face down on a pile. I'm Bobby Dickerson. And
he's pounding on you?
I'm on top of him, okay. But it's just a pile. It's just a swarm. I mean, and I could hear it. And it was a big night in New Britain. I don't know why, but there were maybe 7,500 people. There may be fireworks or something. There's 7,500 people in the stands. It's a huge brawl. You know, 25 people in a pig pile. I can hear my mother. I can pick up my mother and my sister in the stands.
And you're giving Dickerson
headshots. I'm on the
bottom
of the pile. And like, it's just, it's bizarre, but it's just, you know, small world, man. And every once in a while, I'll see a Bobby Dickerson reference on Instagram, because he does some good defensive work, does some neat stuff, but it's a small world.
Yeah.
And by the way, what are you, 58? What are you?
Yes, now I am.
Yeah. So, I mean, and I wouldn't mess with you now. Obviously, you could still throw down on the bench. And so, next time you talk to Bobby,
I'm going to send him this clip.
You took a few shots at him.
Well, I don't know. We're at the bottom of the pile. So at the end of the day, it looked cool. You know, first of all, you have to protect your teammates. But Bobby's a good guy. You know, I'm in the lineup. I don't want to get suspended or anything. You know? So it's just, we just, you know, ended up in that pig pile.
Oh, my
so,
God.
Well, it's crazy. You know, me dropping that name is something that's it's unique to sports in general, but I think baseball, right?
You know, everybody knows everybody.
Everybody knows everybody. You know, you and I met for the first time face-to-face last summer, right? I'd known your son since he was probably 10 years old playing against my son in all-star tournaments and stuff. But I never even realized I watched you play in AA against the Albany Colony Yankees, and I didn't know that until somehow I was just lumbering through some stuff in the basement and I found an old scorecard and your name popped up on it. And like, you know, what are the chances of that?
And that's when you became friends with Bobby Dickerson.
The same time, 1989.
Interesting. And I am not 100% certain he's who he hit, but I know he's who I ended up in the big pile with. I know Al Sanders threw it.
Oh, that's funny. Wow. Yeah. We're talking with Ray Fagnant, the Northeast Regional Scout for the Boston Red Sox. So going back to your story, you get those cups of coffee, you know, in the minors. When do you make the transition out of being a player?
Well, it was, you know, 90, I was in New Britain, or 90 was in Florida State League, 91 up in New Britain. And so, you know, 92 in spring training, one of the coaches asked, hey, Ray, do you throw a good batting practice? So I knew, okay, I'm not going to catch you. I'm not going to be catching Fenway. But I think they recognized that, you know, I knew the game pretty well and wanted to stay around. And one thing that helped me was backup catcher, you catch a lot of bullpens. So the pitchers got really comfortable throwing to me. And so one in particular, Paul Quantrill, who had a good career, I mean, 14, 15 years.
Yeah, I remember when he was drafted by the Sox.
Yeah. He liked throwing to me. So I think he helped kind of keep me around a little bit because he was pitching. I got to catch him. And the irony there, you go full circle, his son Cam, we had on our East Coast Pro and Area Code team when he was a prospect. So, you know, we have the East Coast Pro Showcase up in Syracuse, and I caught – I caught one of his son's bullpens, and Paul was in the stands. I said, Paul, man, I've gone full cycle, you know, full circle.
That's incredible.
I've caught two generations of Quantrill bullpens. But, you know, they kind of knew I wanted to be around the game, so.
You were still playing.
Well, I got released. So okay. The last, I guess, spring training in 92, so the last year playing was 91. And so I was back at Cigna again. And that's when I still wanted to play. I had something in the works with I'd been talking to the White Sox. It's something that works with an independent team in affiliated baseball, which doesn't exist anymore. But this is before the Indy Leagues. But there was an independent, a co-op team in Salinas, California, in the Cali League. I was going to go play there. But I got a call from Billy Enos, longtime Red Sox scout, you know, 55 years in the game. And he asked me if I was interested in scouting because he was retiring and he kind of handpicked me. And
how did he
signed me. And he kind of recognized that, you know, I'm sure I got good reports from the managers in as much as in spite of my stats, you know, I guess it was, you know, valuable to have around, you know, because, you know, it was a struggle for me to get there. So it's pretty good in the clubhouse. But in terms of, you know, catching, I thought I had some pretty good aptitude, was good in the bullpen. In fact, after the year in 91, like the manager there was Gary Allinson, and the farm director, they had me write reports on the pitchers.
Too, right?
He was a catcher too. They had me write reports on the pitchers. And so, they recognized I wanted to stay in the game. And, you know, Bill had signed me, watched me play a lot at Assumption, and thought I'd be a good replacement for him. And so that's
touching.
When
I have to tell you that, like, that's a testament to you. I don't know you from Adam before I met you today, but, like, for somebody to go out of their way and think of you like that without you, I mean, that's, there can't be any higher compliment, in my opinion.
And every day I think about what I have in baseball, which has kind of defined my life in a little bit. It's because of Bill Enos and also because of Bob Whalen, who signed me originally. And, you know, they were both very good, very competitive, but very good friends. So it's just, and I think it's all just from, you know, passion of the game and just loving to play. So that's, you know, that's how we ended up in scouting.
Did you ever see yourself in that role, or were you looking to stay in the game and become a coach or a manager? Because I know a lot of catchers make that transition very easily because of the stuff you talked about, familiarity with the players, the pitchers, and that kind of stuff.
You never think about when you're actually playing. You don't ever think about your career afterwards.
Is that a good or a bad thing?
I guess a little both, because you just envision yourself playing forever. But you get a little bit realistic when you start looking at the stats. And you know, I knew it at one point. I knew, you know, I wasn't playing the big leagues.
But you wanted to stay in the game.
I absolutely knew I wanted to stay in the game. So I remember calling my wife, we weren't yet married at that point, but calling her and saying, you know, Billy Enos from the Red Sox called me. She knew who he was, and she got it. You know, I told her they want to give me a scouting job, and she said, this is perfect. And again, this is her, you know, just the smartest human being I've ever met, but just knowing what's going on. She said, well, I'm very sorry, but congratulations. Like, she got it. Like, this is, at some point in time, you know, you're going to stop playing. Like, I talk about this a lot. Very few people retire. David Ortiz retired. Derek Jeter retired. You know, of course, you know, Yadier Molina. There's a lot of others, but everybody else, no matter how good you are, mm-hmm. one day somebody tells you you can't play anymore.
That's true, by the way, in my business too. I mean, it's very few people choose their ending. It's usually chosen for you. In media, it's 100% true. Mm-hmm. So I think that's pretty fascinating. And I also think it's that I'm sorry and congratulations. I mean, if she knew you were the one then, she was staring down the barrel of having her husband or her boyfriend gone a lot.
Yeah, and that was,
she knew that.
That's a huge commitment. Yeah. I mean, that is a point where she could have been like, I don't think this is right for you. Let's, right. this I want a family. So you got yourself a very supportive woman.
Yes.
That's for sure.
It's an interesting side story there. I remember shortly before our wedding, and my wife told me this, you know, after the fact, we still talk about it. Well, I believe one of her uncles, who kind of knew the game a little bit, pulled her aside and said, you know what you're getting into. You know, so he knew and she knew. So it's just, you know, she's the only reason I'm still doing this, unequivocally. And, you know, the timing was perfect too, because we met, you know, we weren't married yet in the first couple of years. We weren't married, and she was finishing up law school and her degree. So she had something else going on, you know. So her extra time was occupied, if you will, by getting a law degree and a really good job. And it was all those long trips, but it's, you know, it's a tremendous concession and sacrifice on her part, but she's been so immensely supportive. Mm-hmm. And she knew from, you know, the day I met her, from our first romantic date at the batting cages back in Worcester, Mass. You know, that's literally, that's, you know, that was our first date.
That's a good first date, though. Ice cream, little hitting.
My first date was Burger King in the batting cages, and I married her, too.
There you go.
Burger King, huh?
I was a big spender in high school, man.
That is phenomenal. Ray Fagnan, who's the Northeast Regional Scout for the Boston Red Sox. I mean, we could talk for days, but I think, you know, as we go along with the progression here, so you take Mr. Enos's job as regional scout, and this is 1993.
This is 93, my first year scouting. Yep.
And so,
and this is the same position now, 30 years later.
Yes. Which I'm happy with.
Well, there's a couple questions there, but I don't want to get to it yet. Like, why not do other stuff? But I want to get to that. But to me, you know, I read Michael Lewis's book in, was it 2003, I think, is when I read it. And I felt like I was on the ground floor. When did you read it, John? I mean, did you read
Moneyball?
Yeah.
I don't read books, dude. I watched the movie.
Okay, so you
Brad Pitt was enough for me.
Well, I love baseball too. I couldn't hit a curveball, and I was a lefty with no control. So my career was over very early, and I took up tennis. But I love baseball. I always have. And so they really satirize the scout in the movie, especially, you know, with the old guys with the hearing aids and the looking for Fabio. He plays for Seattle, but somehow you survived the transition. And so I guess I'm curious to start. What was the job like pre-2000, and how different is it now?
You know, it's interesting. That movie was very polarizing a lot of ways. Like you said, the depiction of, quote, old scouts was really borderline insulting.
You were offended by it.
Yeah, it was offensive to these, you know, fictitious men. But, you know, yeah, they're old, you know, hearing aids. Like, it was very bizarre. And I know several scouts with the A's. You do too. You mentioned, you know, and,
Tommy Clark.
Yeah, but it's just almost satire. But like I told somebody, the guy that signed Babe Ruth probably looked at his stats. Nobody in the history of baseball has ever signed somebody without, you know, doing some digging, doing some research. You know, even I remember one year doing an open trial camp up in Bangor, Maine, and finding some kid. He had a lot of physical ability. You know, you can sign him just based on the physical ability, but it's imperative. Just do a little, you know, what kind of baseball background does he have? Good, bad, or different, it's important to know. But, you know, the stats have always been around. And, you know, being a math geek, you know, I had a master's in math, and, you know, I was an actuary. Like, my friends and I playing Strat-O-Matic baseball back when we were 12 years old.
That's a rough game.
Yeah. I mean, we were coming up with statistics, my friends and I, you know, 20 years before Bill James wrote his books. So, you know, the stats weren't that much. And a lot of the stats now, it's, hey, let's take this one, divide it by that one. We got a new stat. It sounds cool. But
so your perspective wasn't surprised, but the nature of the game changed. Like, what was asked of you didn't change at all?
There was a lot deeper dive into stats. But I think analytics is such a big blanket statement that's thrown over everything. You know, to me, analytics isn't somebody's, well, batting average, and we progress to OPS, and we got WOBA, then we progress to ex-WOBA, a defensive VORP, and all that stuff. But to me, that's stats. The analytics is some of the sophisticated systems we have where we've got a video technology information system where, say there's a hitter that I like, and we're kind of questioning his ability to hit a fastball. Well, I can go in, I can query, we'll look at fastball counts. I can look at every fastball this guy in a 2-0, 3-1, 0-0 situation.
Just by clicking a few buttons.
Every fastball, every pitch in a fastball situation, above 92, and I can pull it up and I can see his video. It's interesting because I showed it to somebody and they said, this is remarkable, but it goes to show how close theoretically you are to being obsolete, but somebody's got to identify the players. And at the end of the day, somebody can say that, well, their ex-WOBA against fastballs between 92 and 97 and a fastball count is X. All right, well, I think part of it is my job to say, well, why do I think it can improve, or why do I think he's not a prospect? Or you still always need that degree of evaluation.
Like, can we work with this guy? Is he teachable? Yeah. That kind of stuff.
It's huge. And I'm glad you just hit on that word, because there's no statistic for teachable. And it's such an important, it's so important, as important than ever, to know the personality and the makeup and the background and the family, and, you know, do that digging. It's getting to know these guys. It's huge.
And what? Go ahead.
How important, I mean, you say it's important, but how important is, have you ever went to like an ultimate extreme to get to find the character of a person you're evaluating? Like, have you went and contacted, you know, the babysitter, or, you know, that babysat this kid when he was 12 years old, or was he, you know, that kind of stuff? Or did you talk to like the high school gym teacher or something like that? It wasn't his coach, that kind of stuff.
Well, Dave Dombrowski said, if you didn't talk to the school janitor, you didn't do your homework. And I remember watching a player, Pedro Alvarez, played a long time in the big leagues. And it was at the Horace Mann School in the Bronx. And yeah, I went to the restroom between innings, and I see the high school custodian. And I said, I'm going to ask him about Pedro Alvarez. And I did, literally. I asked him, he had some good information. But my favorite story, a pitcher, I remember every detail, but I'm blanking his name now, but he's up in New Hampshire. This is about 10 years ago. He got to the big leagues, but I was at the game early, and there was some, you know, school had gotten out, and there were some kids, you know, in the back of the school on skateboards. You know, they had all the piercings, you know, God bless them. They were doing their thing, but, you know, they all got good kids. But I went over and I said, hey, do you know, you could probably find it, but I forget his name. I said, I'm just curious. I said, I'm a baseball scout. I don't know you. You don't know me, but this is all anonymous. I said, do you know such and such? And he looked at me and said, yeah, we know him. And he said, obviously, you know, we don't hang out with him, but he's a good kid because he says hi to us, treats us with respect. And that stood out. That went a long way. But it's things like that and talking to people around them, or all of the events we run, like the East Coast Pro, or, you know, the area codes or the summer rivalry, where we are in uniform in the dugout with these kids. You know, I remember vividly being in Lakeland at Tigertown, the East Coast Pro. You know, Mike Trout was on our team. And there was a shortstop. It's after the third inning. He comes up to me and said, hey, coach, am I good? I said, yeah, you're a pretty good player. What do you mean? He goes, no. Hey, I'm being sarcastic, but I knew what he meant. He goes, no, am I good? I said, what do you mean good? He goes, well, I played my three innings. I said, do you want to play more? He goes, no, I think I'm all set.
Jeez.
And I said, hey, somebody go and play short. So Trout, coach, I wasn't on Mike. Get to center field. Get out there. And so
Trout was like, I'll go play short.
Yeah, I'll go play short.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you immediately wrote the other guy off.
Oh, and so somebody grabs their glove. Coach, can I play short? I said, yeah, go out there. So I could see it register in that player's face. I just, you know, I just
shot myself in the foot.
But it, long story short, he got drafted out of high school, did not sign, went to a big school, was a pretty high pick, was out of the game in 2 years. And it was just, that was just an instant red flag. Whereas Trout, and again, it's you know, Trout, iconic generational player. That's the easy one to point out. But we knew him well before he was that generational player because we had him on our scout teams. And, you know, longtime scout, you know, Connecticut guy, Greg Morehart. I'm sure you know the name. He scouted for a lot of teams. He played with his dad in the minors. He played with his dad, Jeff, who was a really good two-sport athlete, University of Delaware, who got up to AAA. And so he, you know, his sophomore year, he said, hey, I'll bring him to our workout. A pretty good kid. But we got to know him at an early age. And not in a million years could I have told you he's going to be a Hall of Famer and an iconic generational talent. But I could have said, I guess the best thing you can say about a player at that point is this guy's an everyday big leaguer. And those are big words from an amateur scout, you know, when you're in high school.
Because you don't want to put that out there and be wrong.
Well, I've learned more and more, they really, you know, they'd rather you be aggressive and be wrong. You know, that was Dave Dombrowski's big thing. He says, if I ask you a question, give me an answer. I don't care if it's wrong, but just be convicted. But just putting the label of an everyday major league player, like that's really good. And so I went to see him. You know, we had him at all our events, and I went to see him play basketball, you know, senior year in the winter. And I walked in the gym in Millville. They're playing St. Augustine's Prep. And there's not a kid under 6'5". Four of the guys are going on to play Division I basketball, and the one that wasn't was 6'5", going to play tight end at Penn State. And Mike Trout, at 6 feet tall, maybe, was the center, and he just battled for 32 minutes like I've never seen. That said an awful lot about him.
Yeah, Scott, I talked to a lot of scouts in a lot of different sports, and they see a lot. And I tell my kids, you know, what you do in the outside the sport that you're known for matters, and little things matter. Huge. And if you're a running back who's getting recruited and you're lazy as a safety, that matters. I mean, all that stuff matters. You back checking in hockey. But I want to go back to one quick thing here. We're talking with Ray Fagnant, who's the Northeast Regional Scout for the Red Sox. And because I want to sort of stay on point, you talked about how, you know, being listened to. But I guess my point is with the intangibles and the data, and you have a really good answer. But is it still being listened to by the Blooms and the Breslows and the Deep Podestas of the world?
I think it is because ultimately, again, now it's the best general managers, the best scouting directors can take all the information and just combine it, make a decision. It's just that we have more information than ever before. So you just don't want to ever have information overload, but just you look at what's important. But it's just there is so much more information. And again, go back to the information. And like I said, when I talk analytics, I mean that specific stuff they can look at that involves like a not just statistical, but a baseball talent component. I asked the scouting director, you know, I really
I'm not
like,
trying to get you to like knock on Bloom and Breslow. I'm wondering if across the baseball world, if the intangible elements are still respected by the people who make the decisions above.
I think it is because 2 years ago, Brian O'Halloran, you know, was the Red Sox. His title was GM. We traded for a player, and he called me. You know, anytime you see your cell phone, you say general manager. Ooh, okay. You know, but he called me and said, Ray, we're looking to trade for this guy, and he was an amateur in your area, and I read your background report. And what a background report is, we have the player evaluation. Then the background report is specific questions about their makeup, their attitude, their family, their work ethic, their discipline, things like that. And he said, we read your background report, and it stood up because the grades on that were higher than anyone, you know, any of the other ones we've read. So that was a general manager looking at a background report.
From X amount of years ago.
From too. When he was an amateur. And you hope character really doesn't change. You know, but that's, you know, that was interesting. That meant a lot to me. So I really think they do. And, you know, when I had my performance appraisal a couple weeks ago, and, you know, Devin Pearson, the scouting director, who we love, you know, asked me, Ray, what do you think you need to work on? And I said, well, just getting some admin stuff in. He goes, specifically, my background reports, because I said, I know these players, but I kind of procrastinated a little bit, you know, getting the background reports in. And specific to your question, he said, yeah, just make sure you do that because when we're going through these reports in the offseason, you know, when I know you got some good players in, you know, Brez is going to want to, you know, he'll look at the evaluation, but the next thing he's going to go to is a background report. So to answer your question, absolutely. And, you know, a quick anecdote about makeup and background, like I'll tell players, I don't make the decision on whether we take you or not. But a lot of times I kind of make the decision on whether we don't take you. And I was at the draft 1 year in Secaucus at MLB Studios. And I think this was 2011 when UConn had the big year with Springer, Barnes, Ahmed. They had seven players drafted in the three first rounders. But I was in I was on the bus. We were leaving the hotel. I was on the bus and I'm looking around and within 10, 12 feet of me, you know, there's four or five Hall of Famers. You know, we're going over to the studio because, you know, they have a team representative and a player legend. And so the phone rings and was Amiel Sade, who at that time was our scouting director. And so he said, Ray, get somewhere quiet. I'm going to call you in 60 seconds. So I go back in the hotel. I go in the corner. Phone rings. And he says, okay, Ray, we've got John Henry, Larry Lucchino, Tom Werner here. We got the whole front office. You're on conference call. We picked, I don't know, maybe 14 or 17, I forget. But he said, we got three players lined up with our pick that we think will be there. And one of them was Matt Barnes. And it's a good story because he's a local kid. He said, Matt Barnes, yes or no, right now. And they weren't, you know, it wasn't talents because, you know, we had these guys slotted. If we didn't take him, we had somebody that we thought at that point was the ability was similar. But they said, Matt Barnes, yes or no. And that is a 100% makeup, background, personality, character question. And I said, yes, I'm 100% in. And we ended up taking him. And he had a heck of a career with the Red Sox. You know, he's healthy now. I hope he continues to pitch well for three or four more years. But his fourth all-time in appearances with the Red Sox. But that's a story that I tell sometimes to tell these players how important, you know, the character and the makeup is. And sometimes it does come down to the area guy.
Yeah.
Like that. But I don't think I ever told Matt that story, but you know, I met with him over the winter at his home. I saw how he interacted with his little brother and his parents. He's great at games. You know, I mean, he's a projected first-round pick, but he still went out of his way. He had time to talk to me. And to see how he competed, it was just he had, you know, it helped that he threw 98, but he just had all the components. But the character was the big part, and the GM, the front office, really looks at that. So, again, here, short story long, yes, Craig Breslow will be looking at my background reports, and so did Haim, and so did Dave Dombrowski before him. It's an important part of it. Dave especially was huge on personality and character and makeup of these guys.
Of course, he's less of a data guy. He's a gut guy. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you talked about Barnes and being a New England guy and you being the Northeast scout and from this area. Obviously, your job over the last, I'd say 20 years, but especially the last 10 years, has probably become a lot more involved. And when I mean involved, I mean there's more people, there's more focus on this area. Back in the day, you know, it was probably, oh, I'll go to the University of Maine and play, right? Now it's UConn. Now it's these Division III schools, these Division II schools in the area that people are, you know, and high schools and prep schools. I guess
in 94, my buddy played at Harvard. They didn't even have a full-time baseball coach.
Right. So it's like, you know, like even like Uhart, they were like up until like even like 3 years ago, they were bussing their kids to batting practice. They didn't even have stuff on the field at the campus. But I guess my question is, how much more important is your area that you cover now? I feel like it's got to be way more important than it was 20 years ago.
It is. And you have to know everybody because they end up places for a reason. And now more so than ever with the transfer portal, you know, guys just show up somewhere. There was a pitcher last year, Ryan Bouchard, Niagara County Community College. How he ended up there, I don't know. But he's there, comes out throwing 97. But there can be somebody everywhere. It's not like football. There's, you know, and I follow college football in the sense that, you know, like the process. I'm interested in these D2s and these D3s kind of as a just – you know, how it kind of relates or is similar or dissimilar to baseball. But baseball, you know, more than any sport, you know, there's a long list of Division II and III and JUCO and NAIA players that are at a school for a particular reason. Because I think it's fair to say baseball more so than basketball or football is more of a skill sport where you can really develop. If you're not 6'5", 300 pounds, you're not playing line at a power five.
Right.
If you're not 6'7", 6'9", you're not playing Division I
basketball.
But you can be 5'7", Dustin Pedroia, and you can be, you know, literally any size, and you can develop. We see a lot.
This is a really interesting topic because I have a son who's a JVer who basically got pushed out of baseball, and I see little leagues are decimated because it's a pay-to-play sport. So what's interesting to me, I'm sure that you're right. But at the same time, the pool is smaller. And what disappoints me, I guess, like my son like played JV and he wasn't a recruited kid, so he didn't play a lot. And he got the same thing that happened to you in the minors. He would get an at-bat. He was a kid who never hit for power but never struck out. And if you give him 5 at-bats a game, he's going to get on base 3 times, even, you know, whatever. Getting 1 at-bat a game, he never could do anything. And now he's going to play golf, you know, and so – I think about the players you talk about, that's true. You can be a late bloomer. You don't have to fit a certain template of size. But at the same time, like the game, I feel like the game has been hurt by the pay-to-play culture, which you both are involved in.
Yeah.
And it's helped both of your children.
Well, we talked about this. You know, my son wants to play in college. Your son just committed to play D1. And
your other son, where's he going?
He's going to University of Richmond. And I'll tell you, that was a battle. To be very objective as a baseball scout, he's the third one always gets the benefit of all the BP and chasing all the balls, the other ones. Right. But, you know, and again, small town, he's playing varsity as a freshman, but he's 500 as a freshman. You know, was all state, first team all state last year, and just stood out at the East Coast Pro and the Erie Codes and the PG National. And this August, we just get back from the Erie Codes. He said, "Dad, he's a left-hand hitter. I just faced a low slot lefty throwing 96 and hit a missile to right field. And there's all these 6'4", beautiful bodied athletic kids punching out 5 times, and they're the prospects." And I said, "Well, that's reality." I said, "At the end of the day, way down the line, the end game, you know, the talent, the game rewards a talent at the end. But the recruiting is just, it's painful nowadays, because if you're exactly it, if you don't fit that template, you know, you're going to all these showcases, if you don't fit that template, you don't have the good exit velocity off the tee. And, you know, the big thing on Instagram, if you're not, you know, at one of these cages, you know, throwing 98 on your pull downs with all your buddies yelling in the background, and you run and crow hop and throw a ball 98 against the screen, like, that's, you're not getting a lot of attention, but you are absolutely right. So
But how do you separate yourself from the scout to the parent and deal with that as your son? Because I know my son is good enough to play D3 baseball. Now, it might not be like Eastern Connecticut. It could be, you know, a lower D3. But he doesn't fit the 6-foot mold. I've had many camps where the coaches won't even look at him when he's in the box, even though he's had talking to your son. I remember watching him when he was 10 years old, and I could tell just by his swing that he had the tools. Like, the kid could play. And then as he got older and I watched him, you could clearly see that he had the talent, but he's not a big kid. He's well-built, but he's not 6'2", 108 pounds. So how do you, as you're going through this process, and it's getting later and later and later, mm-hmm. and he doesn't commit, how do you change yourself from the scout evaluating your kid to being a father and telling him, hang in there, it's going to get better, but maybe knowing that it might not get better? Based on what we just talked about.
It was hard as a parent because it was persistence, because what I would deal with all the time, or people would just assume, you know, that he was on any of these teams because he's my son. And we're out at the PG National in Arizona in July. And I have to cover it, but I'm there kind of watching him too. And he's one of four guys in New England that's there. And, you know, again, he's facing some big right-hander, up to, you know, 94. His first at-bat, line drive, base hit up the middle. And somebody comes up to after the game, hey, James, nice hit. And like my son looked at him, and I think he wanted to deck him because it was almost so, I don't want to say condescending. I'll say it was completely condescending.
Who was it? Was it a coach or a scout or was it a fan?
It was a parent. And it's almost like, wow, you're here because your dad's here. Wow, you got a hit off this kid. He's good. And he was mad.
Yeah.
And
but that's got to be tough for him too, though, because he's a smart kid. And he knows that people are probably thinking that way.
So, you know, it was late August. It's late August, and he doesn't have anything yet, in spite of being so proactive about reaching out to these coaches and everything. But I just told him. I mean, part of it too, which kind of helps, is we're a family of faith, so we figure you keep working, something's gonna pan out. And he had some, you know, D3 options, which are awesome. He had some really good ones. And I'd always tell him that. It doesn't matter where you play, as long as you play. But, you know, a couple of schools right at the end. And it was almost like I was telling you, just being persistent, getting on the phone and calling these guys and kind of saying, hey, I did X, Y, and Z at these events. What's your story? What do you got? And part of it is, you know, some of these schools I was watching, like I tell us, you know, he'd tell me, Dad, I could play there right now. I said, listen, I know you can. But you know you're not 6'4", and you did not run a 6'3", 60. So it's just persistence. But there is a crossover from being the dad to the scout. And as a scout, obviously our job is to sign major leaguers. But I've taken more enjoyment, got more satisfaction out of signing some guy that, you know, obviously you want to sign big leaguers, but you recognize that they will have organizational value, and you recognize these kids, like, it's their dream to play. And because I was kind of that guy, and you don't, by no means do you ever lower your standards, but you might look at these guys a second or third or fourth time, because, you know, some scouts, or I guess in any profession, you could be that, you know, contrarian, just negative, where, you know, instead of looking for why guys can't play, look at things that why they can play. What can this guy do? And so, those are the guys that you want to sign that you think they've got a chance. And at the end of the day, the game rewards. I mean, you know, Dustin Pedroia has got a ton of ability. Jose Altuve is a Hall of Famer. You know, there's a lot of those players that, first of all, they have immense ability. But I'm wondering nowadays, if Jose Altuve or Dustin Pedroia showed up at one of these showcases at 5'6", you know, what would their ranking be on the internet?
Right. Or would they just be turned around and get back in the car?
Template. You know, so obviously these guys have worldly Hall of Fame ability, but I think some people would have missed it because, oh, he's not 6'3", or he's not that 6'1 middle infield that runs a 6'4", so I'm going to look at somebody else that ran a good 60, because I can read a stopwatch. I can't evaluate ability, but I can read a stopwatch. So at the end, at the way, way at the end, the game does reward the ability, but it can be awfully frustrating to get there, and more so frustrating as a parent to watch your child, I'm not going to say struggle, but meet these biases, I guess.
Yeah.
So what I'd like to do, I'd like to split this into two, Ray, because this is too good. And so we're going to wrap this up for episode 139, and then we'll come back with 140, and we'll talk about, with Ray, why he's still scouting all these years later. And also, we have some fun rapid-fire questions about baseball for him as well. He's Ray Fagnan. He's the Northeast Regional Scout for the Boston Red Sox. John Senecal, Brian Shackman. You've been listening to Fanbase, a deep dive into the greatest rivalry in sports.